the problem I want to talk about today is black hole excision. That's the whole motivation for this work that I'm doing. And we're not there yet. It's just, this is a very preliminary work. We've only been working on it for roughly a month. And my collaborators, Joel Calabresi, is also at LSU. And what we wanted to do was look at the problem of black hole excision from a very essential formal approach. There have been a lot of different ways that people have tried to do excision, and there are some things, good things that have come from that. We wanted to step back and take a more formal approach, especially for the case where you have some 3D grid, say, and you have a excised inner boundary. We wanted to look at what you have to do to make this inner boundary move with respect to the grid. So there are approaches to do excision where the boundary is fixed. We wanted to look at the other case where the boundaries move. The guiding philosophy is essentially we want to look at both the continuum problem and the discrete problem together and make sure we're doing the right thing in both cases. We want to make sure that we have a well-posed initial boundary value problem at the continuum. And that requires certain things. For it requires we have a symmetric hyperbolic system. We have smooth initial data, and we have boundary conditions that are given in a very specific form. The maximally dissipated form is what we're using. If we have these ingredients, then we can guarantee that we have a well-posed initial boundary value problem at the continuum. Now, that's the continuum problem. We want to then translate that into a discrete problem. And let me say it this way. If we have these conditions and we have certain, the continuum solution has certain properties, the most important of which is that the solution at any time depends continuously on the boundary data and the initial data. And the important thing is it depends continuously. So if you make small changes, you don't expect large changes at a later time in the solution. We would like our discrete system to have the same property. And really, this is kind of the, when we talk about convergence for a discrete system, this is the analog to well-posedness for a continuum system. If we have a convergent code, then small changes in the initial data and the boundaries do not lead to wild changes or blow-ups at a later time. So we're trying to preserve as many of these properties in our discrete system as we can so that we come up with convergence. So the approach that we take in looking at the discrete system is we construct the discretization and essentially almost everything about the problem with what's known as the energy method. And what this involves is writing out the semi-discrete system, which means we have, say our continuum system is, looks like this. Then we write the semi-discrete form, where now we have finite differences. I have a finite difference operator here. This is the semi-discrete system. For the semi-discrete system, we construct two things, an energy and a differential operator that satisfies something called summation by parts that Manuel talked about in his talk last week. Secondly, the boundary conditions for the discrete system are applied using a very specific type of projection operator. The boundary conditions are projected onto the right-hand side of the system. And again, these are in maximally dissipative form. And we are projecting, say, the incoming modes in a special way. And this special way is designed so that it doesn't ruin anything about the discrete system at this level. The one thing I forgot to mention here, so I'm trying to remember what my slides looked like. I should have printed them out, but at least. No, it doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work either. So. No. We did so many things to the X that we'll have to go back and reconfigure it. This energy method, what I forgot to say is there are two things here. There's an operator, a differential operator, and a discrete energy. What we want to show is we have a discrete energy that's conserved, because if we have a discrete energy that's conserved, the system cannot blow up if we have smooth data and appropriate boundary conditions.
To do that, you need a continuum energy that's conserved.
And to do that, we need to have a continuum energy, yes. Yeah, it's the discrete system will only have the properties of the continuum problem. So that's an important part of the analysis as well.
Whose map is it? When Manuel talked about it, he said that he was talking about the linearized system. So.
Yes, these hold formally only for a linear set of PDEs, a linear set with variable coefficients. Now you might say, what the heck does this have to do with solving nonlinear systems? But our approach is, you look at the linear problem first because that's the simplest, and really all finite difference approaches begin with the linear problem because that's the only thing you can solve. So you do the linear problem right, and then you pray that the nonlinear problem is not going to cause you even more difficult, you know, won't blow up in your face, basically. So yes, we're looking at the linear problem first because we want to do the linear problem right. Then we're going to just go to the nonlinear and then you cross your fingers. But
so when you say you have exact energy conservation, does that mean that you have a non-dissipative
thing?
Is that basically what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you use your
non-dissipative? If you want to kill the non-linearity.
Yeah.
Can you use the energy as a measure of the stability of your system? Like you have a finite difference code that does you don't know what, but you compute the energy defined by your rules and you dump it abnormally. Times that I look at that and that should be telling you whether your system.
Yes, that's formally possible. Now, in actuality, this energy does change, but the change in energy is dependent only on the boundary conditions. So if we have a wave and we want the wave to leave the grid, obviously the energy is going to change in time as the wave propagates off the grid. But this change in energy is dictated simply by the boundary conditions and not by something else. So if we have a periodic conditions on everything, then yes, we could evaluate this energy and make sure that it is strictly, you know, that it's conserved in the evolution.
And it would be strictly conserved in the linear case?
In the linear, yes. Yeah. This energy can decrease if we put an explicit dissipation operator in there, then it will be we'll have to add another term on here, but it will be something that's negative. So the energy decreases.
Here, he's considering there the case where the time is not discretized. So that level the energy.
Instead of,
but if it's growing, thing, you don't know when.
Yes, but if it's not growing, then at least I would know that I'm doing the right thing. Am I?
Or you're not screwing to that.
Yeah, or I'm not screwing too, or yeah, the balance is in my favor.
Okay, both of these cases apply to the semi-discrete problem only, yeah?
Just one short power error, the non, this is, here you show stability for a linear problem, and it's also true that one strategy is that case if you don't have stability in a linear case, you don't have it in a nonlinear one, so that's first. But there is even more than that, is that the, something I mentioned briefly in my talk, is that the solution to a nonlinear problem can be seen in many cases as the solution of a sequences of, as the solution of a sequence of linear problems. People can show that in many cases. So in that sense, you are even, it's just, it's much more than just having stability in linear cases the necessary condition. In the sense that you can wave hands and say, well, I show stability for each of these linear problems, this sequence, maybe I have stability in linear cases as well. It's not a proof, but it's.
Finally, we have to get to the fully discrete system, which is we use either Runge Kutta 3 or Runge Kutta 4, which has certain stability properties also with respect to these things, so that this energy still holds. There is a discrete energy for the fully discrete system. Okay, that's the basic philosophy, that we examine both the continuum problem and the discrete problem, and try to keep as many of the nice continuum properties in the discrete system. And that dictates that we do things in a certain way. My next point is the boundary conditions are where all the physics is, essentially. And boundary conditions for non-trivial systems usually don't fit nicely in with the grid. Okay, a boundary condition is physically is usually some property that's either normal or transverse to a physical boundary. So in E and M, there are conditions that hold transverse to the surface and normal to the surface. When you're doing a computation and you have something like this, and you're working in Cartesian coordinates, it's difficult to specify those boundary conditions for the discrete problem in a good way. So black holes are a little more forgiving. If you had, you know, a charged sphere, then the electric field lines have to behave in a certain way. For black holes, the nice thing about them is that there is a horizon and everything falls in. And the basic idea of excision is if you put some surface in here, and it doesn't, we'll just say it doesn't matter much right now. We'll have to look at that in more detail. But if I have some surface here that's the boundary of my computational domain, then if I cut these points out inside, then the idea is that nothing can get back out. Okay. So, like I said, you have to look precisely what this surface is and if this really holds for the hyperbolic problem. If you look at the characteristic speeds, where this is respect to, these are the characteristic speeds of the physical characteristic speeds with respect to some surface that has, say, a normal Ni, then this is what I write down for the Fratelli-Royle formulation. These are my characteristic speeds. And what I want to know is if I have some inner boundary that is adapted to my Cartesian grid here, I want to know whether or not there are any incoming modes on this boundary, because that's part of specifying a well-posed initial boundary value problem. And you take the Schwarzschild case as exact solution, and you evaluate this, and what you find is if this whole length is 2L, where this whole thing here is 2R, I'm sorry, to M. This is, say, the event horizon. Then I find that L has to be roughly 0.38 m or smaller, so that there are no incoming modes on this surface.
Well, what is that surface if it's inside? If it's inside an apparent horizon, it's going to be space-like, or
yeah. So the condition for it. That's the idea.
That's the condition that you're looking for.
Yeah.
So there's no theory of boundary conditions which doesn't apply to the space-like case.
Well, it does, because if it's space-like, that means that it isn't really a boundary.
That's right.
I mean, that's why I say you don't need a theory.
There's no boundary.
I'm sorry.
So that's precisely what you build boundary there.
That's precisely what you realize about. You don't know what boundary conditions.
Well, apparently, is part of your initial Cauchy hypothesis.
So the point that he's trying to make is that you
feel space like the other way. It's part of the future.
Right. It's future.
Yeah. So that there is no boundary.
The point he's going to make is that if you have a boundary acyclic box inside a linear structure, that code that's bigger than that, it is not a space. It's being overlooked lots of times. People usually say, well, if you put any boundary inside a black hole, it's a purely outflow boundary. And but it looks like a cubic box, and that's not true. It has to be small, very, very small.
The simple thing is that if you have a trapped surface, that doesn't mean that any surface
exactly. But I mean, you find that in many models of the big paper, saying we were kind of assumption that the single boundary is inside the black hole is a purely outflow boundary, and it's not the case. You do a calculation, that assumption is not true.
This depends upon your lapse and shift.
So
that's for what?
And the formulation that you're solving.
And the same thing.
Yeah.
But what if your box is bigger and the boundary is time-like, and you just pick any boundary condition you want and you put it as a boundary?
That's a possibility. You could say, well, you know, I'll make a bigger box. I know that there are some incoming modes on this boundary. And they can't get out, so I'll just put 3 there or 0 or something.
But
it's only on part of the boundary.
Each face of the cube, there's a circle on each face of the cube, and inside of that circle, then there's no outgoing modes on that face, on inside of that circle. But on the outside, then you have to put a boundary.
And what if you construct a level sphere which is a time-like in its imperative,
space-like in its imperative?
I'm talking about the boundary, which is a time-like boundary inside the horizon. Can you do that?
No. Well, you can do it, but it won't last very long.
No, there's
no. We have the singularity quick.
So it doesn't work there. I'm not getting. So we are saying that if it's inside the horizon, then it's space-like.
No. You have to look at the particular surface.
Inside the horizon, just to bring your charge.
I'm talking about the level boundary, which is a sphere.
Plus or minus.
Okay.
If it is a sphere, then it's going to be space-like. If it is an exact
sphere, then it's fine.
Right.
Like what they do, they can put the code at 2 minus epsilon, and it's fine.
Okay, if you build a Lego sphere, the normals of this boundary are still the Cartesian surfaces, right? Okay. So you still have to use the Cartesian normal vectors. And when you do the calculation, you come up with the exact same answer, because when I do this calculation, it actually doesn't depend on the whole shape of the surface. It only depends on what the normal is at a particular point. And in this particular case, it's calculated with the corner. But if you make a Lego sphere that has a boundary at the same point, it will still have an incoming mode there. You can't cheat the devil with a Lego sphere.
So you're going to get away with a Lego sphere. At least we use an exact or something.
I still don't get it. You construct a Lego sphere, which you know is time-like because it's outside the limit that you set there.
No. Part of it is space-like.
Mark
was saying, part of it will be space-like.
No, it's not a sphere. So at this point, if you look at the normal, that's what David said. If you look at the normal here, they are the
outside, far enough.
Here, if you look at this point, you're in trouble because you don't point to.
But not that. What's the center? Not that particular one. No, you're gonna. They do it.
No, but if you look at the Lego sphere, you cannot get there. We're
far enough.
Oh, pieces of the Lego sphere will be spaced like other pieces.
Exactly.
So if you take a Lego sphere and if you look at the face So you put it at 1.95m or something like that, right? So you have a Lego sphere that's just inside the horizon, right? Then a face that's just along the x-axis, that face will be space-like. But a face that's up here, you know, facing this way,
the actual
might be time-like.
Forget the Lego concept.
Yeah, if the actual sphere, then the whole thing is space-like.
The whole thing is space-like.
Yes.
That's because there's a different normal to the sphere.
That's the geometrical boundary you're trying to approximate.
Yes.
The Lego thing is just your finite difference technique.
Well,
space-like.
If you think of it as a sphere, then it's space-like. But, but these guys, apparently what they're saying is that you can't do that, is that you actually have to worry about what the direction of the faces are.
If you want to have, okay, it's true that with a Lego sphere, you're approximating a sphere that's bounded on the sphere. But if you want to show momentum stability, at each of these points,
the way people treat curve boundaries, you say in a wave relation, I want to treat curve boundary on a Cartesian array. The normal is the normal to the spatial boundary.
If the characteristic direction.
No, this is the way they do it. The normal that they use to define a maximum for the state of P is the normal to the smooth boundary. And then they
We're getting a little out of field here. The main point is, see, we want to look at the continuum problem as well. You can't, okay, if you build a boundary out of cubes, because that's what your Cartesian grid has, is cubes, and you look at the continuum problem, then there are certain conditions for it to be well posed. Okay, now,
very small problem, we can discuss it later, at some point it was mentioned, it was really that, well, I have a big cubic box, right? Which here I have some models going to the domain and I put boundary conditions to one, right? So we can discuss why, but this doesn't work higher.
We can also talk about the fact that taking a smooth boundary is not as complicated as people thought.
Yeah, okay. This is the point. The boundary conditions are things that are usually normal and parallel. You have to have coordinates that fit the boundary. As a final comment, there is no well-posed cubical excision possible for curves that's known. Okay, so you can do this in a well-posed way at the continuum for Schwarzschild with a very small box. You have to excise very close to the singularity, but for Kerr it's not possible. And one way to think, I mean, you have the ergosphere that's moving things around, and you have and then you have the ring singularity, and there's no cube you can build inside there, so that if at the continuum you have a well-posed problem. So the main point of all of this is that you have to have some type of coordinate system that adapts to the local symmetry of the problem. There are different ways to do that, and some people have mentioned them. One is, take your Cartesian grid, you build a sphere here, and this is now your grid. It looks just like this, where you have points defined at all of these intersections. This is a true circular boundary on a Cartesian grid. And if you want to take the x and y derivative at this particular point, then there are rules for doing that. So it forces you to do some complicated differencing around this true spherical boundary or circular boundary in this Cartesian grid. Mark showed yesterday another way to do it, where you take your cubic domain, say here, you have a spherical inner boundary, and you choose different patches around the sphere, and you use coordinate transformations so that part of the cubical patch that is in one domain, a cube, gets mapped into something that fits as the sphere. That's another approach. The approach I want to talk about today, there's also the possibility of using an unstructured mesh like is typically used in finite elements, where you have little triangles that go all over the place. But they can conform exactly to all the boundaries. The difficulty, of course, is that, well, there are different things about each of these, and then the solution I want to talk about is where you use two different grids. You use one grid that conforms to, say, your outer boundary, Cartesian grid. Then around the boundary at some point, you cut the Cartesian grid off, and over that hole, you place a second grid that looks like this and has the symmetry of the inner boundary. So one grid has the symmetry of the outer boundary, the other grid has the symmetry of the inner boundary, and then there's some rules for matching the two grids in between. This way you have a coordinate system that locally adaptable to the symmetry. You can apply your boundary conditions exactly. There are advantages and disadvantages to each of these. The reason that we are looking at this one is, well, a few reasons. Number one, it has very simple data structures. Each grid is logically Cartesian. It's a logically Cartesian block. That means it can be parallelized easily. It's easily to compute. We don't have to do lookup tables or something like for an unstructured mesh. Another advantage, well, it is symmetry adaptable. But this one has the same advantages. But what we're particularly interested in is having moving boundaries, because we want to have a moving excision region. And overlapping grids seem to be ideal for that, because if this inner boundary moves, then it's easy to let the spherical patch move with it, while the outer boundary, which is held fixed, has a grid that is fixed to that one. So for those reasons, we're looking at using overlapping grids and numeric relativity.
Can I just point out one other method that I think is different from these, which I have in a paper on the web a long time ago, which says you take your scheme, you have your sphere, you've got your chamber and so forth, and in a shell like this, assuming you've got points, I mean you've got your rectangular points in there, you simply do fitting to a spherical harmonic expansion plus something radial, just enough to be able to compute at any point on the sphere the function and its derivative.
The thing that you need, okay.
And the technical advantage of this is that you never have to introduce a spherical coordinate at any place. It's all done in the original rectangulars because the spherical harmonics are all simple polynomials in the rectangular coordinates and overlap, you know, the integrals you do to find the Fourier coefficients and so forth are just straight sums. Everything is just a straight sum over this restricted piece of your original grid. And then you do your computations, you compose the conditions, and so forth. So it's described in terms of just a simple scalar, but I think you could expand the rectangular components of a metric the same way and take derivatives as xi, dxi, so forth, if you want to read it.
So, of course, you keep a condition grid, but you change coordinates?
It's never to change coordinates. Everything is done to
okay. This takes care of basically the symmetry. Now the next part of having a moving inner boundary. Now if we want to look at having an excision region that moves on the grid, let's just look at a toy problem here, where I have some grid here that moves along with some velocity. And these are, say, coordinates x and y. And I want to solve the one-dimensional wave equation along x here. If I have a grid that moves, and let's say it has coordinates c and eta, then write down the 1D wave equation. And what I find, if the basic idea is to solve this equation that's written in T and X in this domain, to find a different set of coordinates that move along with this moving boundary here, xi and eta, and write the same equation in terms of xi and eta. And what you find, and let's say the time coordinate here is tau, and I'm going to skip some steps here, but the end result is basically, well, I won't. I'm going to be sloppy. I'm going to define a new variable t, which is dt phi. And if I write this in my new coordinate system, it becomes d tau phi. I think it's minus the velocity dc phi. And if I do that, then I can write the wave equation is basically something that looks like this. This, the signs here, you're just going to have to forgive because I don't remember what they are exactly, but they look something like this. Oops. And then we have something like that. The main point is we have the usual 1D wave equation. If I wrote this in first order form in this coordinate system, and then we have some additional components that depend upon the velocity of the moving grid. If you want to then ask, okay, can we solve, or do we have a well-posed initial value boundary problem on the moving grid? The answer is yes, as long as the characteristics as long as I supply boundary data in the proper ways, so when where I have incoming modes on the grid, I put their proper data, and we don't want the number of incoming and outgoing characteristics to change. And in this problem, it doesn't matter that much, but we require this so that that doesn't happen. Okay, the main point is you can have a moving boundary. You transform to a coordinate system that moves with the boundary. You rewrite the equations in that coordinate system. You examine the characteristics and hyperbolic structure of the equations in that moving coordinate system. And this tells you how you have to supply boundary data, what the incoming modes on each face are. Okay, so when we go to the black hole excision problem, what we'll do is we'll write, say, Einstein equations in one form. Okay, we'll transform them to a grid, spherical grid that moves along with the hole, and examine the characteristic structure and figure out where we have to apply boundary data. I'm getting lost in my talk here, so I apologize for that. This is kind of where, you know, black hole excision is what we want to do. And so this is preliminary. We haven't worked on this very long. But the model problem that we're working with is solving on a Schwarzschild background the scalar wave equation.
Yeah, and
we're doing this in 2D to simplify things. So we're using a cylindrical coordinate system that's fixed, and then we have I'll just write essentially time-dependent r and theta, so that we have this spherical. Well, let me draw this grid here. So we have something like z this way and rho, and we put on top of that a grid in spherical coordinates. and this moves along. Now, if we solve the wave equation on Minkowski, I have that working, and I have an MPEG that is available somewhere. That used to be available. Actually, I copied it to another machine.
It worked very well to destroy my laptop.
And it destroyed Mark's laptop. If you go to the Penn State meeting, you may see Jorge show it or something. Solving the wave equation on Minkowski space, where we have it working, where we have the spherical grid, and it moves along here. And we have this patch in radial spherical coordinates and this patch in cylindrical coordinates, and the wave equation works fine. Everything works well.
You actually solve everything in spherical coordinates on that patch?
On that patch, everything is solved in spherical coordinates, yes.
And so for relativity, you solve for, you also use spherical basis for the components of your tensors?
Yes.
And so on?
Yeah.
You solve for G, R, R, and G, theta.
Exactly, theta. Yeah. So right now we're doing it that way, and that's actually something I'll have to remember to come back and tell you why we're doing that. Certainly, it would be possible to solve everything in just a cylindrical basis and use Jacobians to change your derivatives. And maybe in relativity, that's what we want to do in the end. But
let me ask you a question, Mark. You guys were doing this before you changed to that. Were you using things as spherical coordinates or everything in
spherical? In spherical coordinates, but in a Cartesian basis, so we're still evolving gx, x, dx, y, etc. And that way, every one of our functions, because if you evolve grr and gr theta, they have different regularity, so you have to use different spherical basis functions for them. But gxx, gxy, gzz, all of those, you can treat as scalars with respect to the spherical harmonics.
The one thing that the next step that I'm working on right now is basically excising the cylindrical grid somehow, covering it with a patch that also doesn't reach the origin, and then treating in Minkowski space, I can put, say, some source or sink of spherical waves right here. And using the exact solution, I know what the boundary data that has to be given right here are. And then you can have spherical waves, and then I'd like to have that source boosted and have the spherical grid follow it. And I think once that's done, then all the technical details of how you match the grids, how you apply the boundary conditions will all be finished. In the black hole case, of course, this inner boundary has to be space-like so that we don't have to do anything here. Everything's outgoing. And that will be that, hopefully. But we'll see. Part of the reason that we're solving everything and we're changing all of the basis to spherical coordinates is going back to something I had up a while ago, and that was the energy method to find the discretization and the conserved energy. We have written these down for both cylindrical coordinates and spherical coordinates. And in spherical coordinates, it requires a spherical basis. And we have Joel has worked out a discrete energy, and he's shown that the energy is conserved, meaning that the change in the discrete energy depends only on the boundary terms, at the semi-discrete level.
For a single patch.
It's for a single patch. Yeah, the interpolation doesn't do that. Okay, I had some movies to show you of these things working, but I just want to get to one final thing. If you have a boosted black hole, this doesn't really fit the horizon won't be a spherical surface. So what I said at the beginning, that you really want boundaries that match the physical boundary, or grid boundaries that match the physical boundary. Right now we're just using spherical coordinates. It's an interesting calculation to check to see what your minimum or your maximum excision radius can be as a function of the boost of the black hole. And if you plot that out, and you have, say, 1 right here, and 0.5, and this is the Voost velocity of the black hole, then the maximum excision radius that we can have is 2m right here, where this is 0. And it is, at half the speed of light, I think it's about right here. And so it falls down like that, the curve, roughly. Okay, again, we don't have coordinates that are...
That's defining R in what way?
So this is the maximum excision radius, which means if we have a, this is now the black hole, and I have the singularity here, and as a function of the boost, we want to know how close this spherical grid has to come to the singularity.
Aerial radius?
What yeah.
By spherical, it's topologically spherical.
It's the this grid is spherical in the rest frame, but the black hole horizon is not spherical in the in this frame. So it's, I mean, it's going to be, it's going to look like this, right? It's going to be contracted in one dimension.
And so it contracts.
But we're just saying, we're using spherical coordinates because that's simple for right now, and we're just beginning.
It basically contracts to 0 in one direction?
Yeah. Roughly.
But that's
a coordinate effect.
You choose a different system where yeah. you're not contracting the grid, but it's spherical.
No, we're not contracting the grid.
So this is entirely the effect of this contraction
yeah.
that you have to put that this thing in.
Yeah.
It.
Again, I have a surface that looks like this, but I'm trying to fit it with things that are
right.
spherical.
You need to fit the excision boundary inside of that thing.
Yeah.
That's
yeah. So these coordinates aren't ideal,
right.
but it's a place to start.
But presumably you can also say contract your spherical grid.
Yeah, I mean, we would maybe want to go to some type of oblate spheroidal coordinates that
yeah,
look a little
to
or
zero,
something.
One direction
it goes to zero. Nothing to do there. Just put the whole moon like this. It doesn't go to zero. It doesn't equal zero, but it comes very close to zero.
Oh,
it's like the closest one I calculated was 0.9, and I think it's like 0.04 or something like that. Okay. Module, the movies, and...
Well, you can get all the material in the movies.
Yeah.
And you can post them, right?
Yeah. Okay. We're sorry for the technical difficulties, but... Any questions?